listening to Spill
on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The nominating committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Pacifica Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Phyllis Bennis, respected frontline expert on Israel-Palestine, assesses the current dangers on a possible major war and deep loss of life. Also, we speak with Richard Silverstein. Are more Jews standing up against the genocide? We're going to do a little talk about that. And Anita Barrows is back, keeping track of the genocide in Gaza, a poem a day, a powerful poem a day. Anita is back. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Got a very strong show for you today, but we're going to begin with our powerful interview with somebody who knows a great deal about what is going on in the Middle East, Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project, and has worked for years at the United Nations and around the world. Delighted to have her on a day like today when Trump is sort of walking that tightrope between World War II and World War III. Where is he? What's going on? Listen to this. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We are delighted to welcome back to these airwaves Phyllis Bennis. She is a fellow of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. She directs the IPS's New International Project. Her work concerns U.S. foreign policy issues, particularly involving the Middle East and the United Nations. Phyllis, it's been a while since we've spoken, but we appreciate your knowledge and your background. And let's come right in the door of where we are in terms of, are we teetering on a global war here? Are we going to see what we have all feared the worst? Trump was certainly swaggering around at his press conference today.
He was indeed. Thanks, Dennis, for inviting me back on. You know, it was shocking, although not at all surprising, to see that the entire presentation from Trump and from his minions focused on the great work they did finding the pilot who had been shot down, and then the bomber in the plane who had been shot down. And yet there was nothing, we heard nothing about what they were doing. What were they bombing? Were they bombing a bridge? As he has said, by tomorrow night, every bridge in the entire country will be destroyed. Was he bombing another girl's school, the way they opened this entire war on the very first day, killing somewhere between 165 and 175 people, of whom the vast majority were 6 to 12-year-old girls. If so, these pilots and bombers were committing war crimes, if these were indeed civilian targets, as so many of their targets have been. So I think that we're in a very dangerous moment when Trump is making these threats that if Iran does not cave in to his demands, in this case to open up the Strait of Hormuz without any actual negotiations, any economic issues, etc. Iran has been quite clear that they are prepared to negotiate, but they are not prepared for a ceasefire that does not include lifting sanctions that have been crippling the economy and the people of Iran. All of those things need to be on the agenda, and Trump has simply refused and said, no, you just have to do it because we tell you to. I don't know where that goes. I don't know if that's going to lead to a massive escalation, as he is threatening to carry out tomorrow night, again, specifically calling for an escalated level of attacks on civilian targets. So he's essentially saying that by tomorrow night, if Iran does not give in, as it were, that he would commit a number of new war crimes. And he's telling us ahead of time that that's his plan. So maybe it's bluster. Maybe this is not an actual intention. We have no way to really know that because there's no real answers coming. This notion from the beginning that this war won't take more than 6 weeks. Well, this is the sixth week, and it doesn't show any signs of letting up. The question of whether it's a world war that we are looking at, I think in one sense, is too late. It's already impacting the whole world, economically in particular, where it's not only about oil. 20% of the oil of the world goes through the Strait of Hormuz in ordinary times, if we can remember ordinary times, but also a vast amount of other goods of all kinds, consumer goods, automobiles, all kinds of things shipped through that transit point. So it's a choke point that right now Iran controls. So what the U.S. plans to do if that control does not change by this arbitrarily set deadline of tomorrow night, we don't know. So it's already affecting the whole world. If we mean the sort of traditional definition of a world war, meaning there's actual fighting going on every continent, one can only hope that it doesn't extend to that degree. But there's no guarantees of any of this, with the question of what role might NATO play, what role might the European Union play, what role might other countries play or not play, what will be the escalated role potentially by the Gulf states if there are more attacks on their oil infrastructure, as well as if, as threatened, Trump would dare to go after the water desalination plants all over the Middle East region, which civilian populations of millions of people are so dependent. So the things we're hearing are horrific, and we just don't know if they're real or if they are designed as sort of bombastic demands on Iran, hoping that they'll be intimidated. We simply don't know.
Well, right now he is certainly the world's most dangerous man in real terms. We're speaking with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. She's also written many books, including the very important work on Israel-Palestine, Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a primer. Obviously, we're talking about what are we talking? What are the multiple? You started to get into that, but the multiple implications also include Israel getting involved in a bigger way, and everybody is terrified about what Israel would or would not do with a bomb in which the atom's already been split. They have the weapon.
They do indeed, and this is very dangerous because it's not being discussed. The Israeli nuclear arsenal, the only nuclear arsenal in the Middle East, there is no other, there is no Arab nuclear weapon, there is no Iranian nuclear weapon, there's only an Israeli nuclear weapon, actually many of them, in the Dimona plant in the Negev Desert. And it's particularly dangerous even if they don't fire a nuclear weapon, which God knows we all have to hope that they don't, and there's a number of pressures that would be brought to bear that prevent that. But even without that, we simply don't know how dangerous those nuclear weapons are because they've never been inspected. Israel does not acknowledge their existence. They maintain a policy of what they call strategic ambiguity, in which they neither confirm nor deny this batch of nuclear weapons that the whole world knows exists, because the an Israeli whistleblower took the pictures and then escaped to Australia to distribute the pictures around the world, and then, of course, as we all know, was arrested and was held in solitary confinement for 18 years. He's now prisoned but isn't allowed to leave the country. But it's known around the world that these weapons exist, but they have never been inspected by the United Nations. They've been around since the early 1980s, late 70s, early 80s. No one knows what kind of shape they're in. Are they leaching radioactive material already into the ground, into the water, into the air, just because the casing around them has eroded? We have no idea. Nobody knows that, except whatever Israeli team manages the plant. When it was announced several weeks ago that a missile, which could have been an Iranian missile, could have been an errant Israeli missile gone astray, it could have been from several sources, we don't know where it came from, but some missile hit the town of Dimona. And when I heard that, I was terrified, because Dimona is the town that holds the Dimona nuclear plant. And there was no indication from those reports how close was this missile to the storage areas where these bombs are held. So there's simply no way of knowing right now what the level of danger might be, even putting aside the question of a nuclear weapon. But we can't put aside that question, because both the U.S. and Israel, of course, are nuclear weapon states. And neither government has shown itself unwilling to use any accessible tactics in this war. So one can only hope that there are people surrounding Netanyahu and people surrounding Trump who recognize what the mere thought of a nuclear weapon means. It's unthinkable, but perhaps people are thinking about it. We don't know.
Well, I, for one, have been thinking about it, and I get calls from people who raise this issue all the time. People are concerned. We are speaking with Phyllis Bennis. And Phyllis, I guess we need to talk about sort of the situation on the ground in occupied Palestine, but we really have to help us understand the devastation that Israel is now reaping on Lebanon, and the implications for the aftermath if these wars stop tomorrow. I mean, this is another dangerous, incredibly dangerous touchstone for expanded war.
It is. The war has already expanded. There's been more than 2,000 people killed by Israeli bombing in South Lebanon. The Israelis are also occupying new swaths of territory throughout South Lebanon, initially up towards the Litani River. It's not clear whether they're holding territory as far up as the Litani, but this is the exact pattern that we saw in the earlier Israeli occupations, invasions and occupations of Lebanon that began in 1978. First, it was up to the Litani River, and then later in 1982, they invaded again and took land right up into Beirut. And we remember the Sabra and Shatila massacres of 1982 that happened under Israeli guarding. They didn't carry it out. They provided the light in the middle of the night to their allies, their right-wing Christian allies in Lebanon, who carried out the massacre. Sharon was found to be partly responsible for it as a result. And for that land was held for a long time. The mobilization of mothers across Israel who were outraged at their sons, it was not so much daughters at that time, but their sons being killed in this war that they saw as being for nothing. There was enough pressure that led to the withdrawal of Israeli troops, but that was after years of occupation. And the occupation of the South is something that has gone on for years at various points, and now we're looking at an occupation which began over a year ago and is continuing. There was a ceasefire that was in November of 2024 and is still being violated by the Israelis. There are still people being killed. There's very little pushback from Hezbollah or other forces against the Israeli forces, and we don't know how long that's going to last. But there's been absolute devastation across the south, with massive amount of housing stock destroyed, other civilian targets destroyed. So the economic cost of rebuilding, even as you say, if the fighting stopped tomorrow, the cost will be extraordinary. We're also looking at that in Tehran. People were talking early in the war about the Gazification of Tehran,
yes,
the level of destruction of housing there.
And scary course, term.
In Gaza.
Very scary
Gaza,
term. Yeah.
Exactly. And in Gaza, of course, which is so rooted in the origins of this war in Iran, it was really the impunity with which the U.S.-backed Israeli military was able to attack Gaza that set the stage for their assumption that they would have impunity to go after Iran as well. And indeed they have. There has been no accountability. The UN resolution several weeks ago that condemned the fighting condemned only one side, and it was not the side that started the war. There was no mention in that Security Council resolution of either the United States or Israel, who collectively began the war on February 28th. And in that context, they were assuming that they would be able to get away with it, and so far they have. The resolution condemned Iran for using its right of self-defense partly in an illegal way. It is true that they have violated international law, did commit war crimes in targeting some civilian targets within the Gulf states that were hosting and are hosting U.S. troops, U.S. bases, U.S. forces, which made them legitimate targets, but the legitimate target was those bases, not the civilian infrastructure in those countries. So identifying that violation by Iran was not inappropriate, but to pass a resolution that did not even acknowledge the carrying out by the U.S. and Israel of what the Nuremberg judges called the supreme international crime, which is the crime of aggression, from which all other war crimes stem, that was not even mentioned in the resolution. It was not even discussed as something that perhaps should be in the resolution. So this is what we now are looking at a global level, this level of impunity, where the U.S. and Israel are able to carry out these horrific wars without any serious, any significant consequence, other than the fact that they are now both considered outliers around the world in a way that's been true for Israel for quite some time, but now is equally true for the United States.
Yeah, unfortunately, they're not considered outliers in the U.S. Congress that still seems to hold sway and be owned by various levels of the Israeli lobby. Does that still present a problem in terms of even a peep of reality coming through the mainstream?
I think there has been a significant shift. There's been a massive shift in public opinion. We've never seen a situation where 77% of Democratic voters, for instance, say no more arms to Israel. The problem that we face is that the majority of the leadership of both parties in the Congress don't recognize that shift in public opinion. And that is a huge problem. There are more and more members of Congress for whom AIPAC has become a toxic word, who are returning AIPAC money, who are refusing to accept AIPAC money. That's never happened before. That doesn't mean that there's no pro-Israel money still coming into Congress, but it does mean that it's not nearly as influential as it has been in the past. So there has been a huge change there. Part of the problem is that the partisan divide in the Congress is so clear that the you know, looking as an analyst, because of course I work for a nonprofit, we don't take positions on parties and candidates, but analyzing the Congress at this moment, when you look at the polls, it's quite clear that the level of support for Israel among Republicans is almost the exact reverse of the diminished support for Israel among Democrats. In the Congress, there's not yet a recognition of how that change has gone forward. So you have not only pretty much all the Republicans who tend to be less out of touch with their base than the Democratic Party leadership, which is very out of touch with its base on that issue, along with the Democrats are aligned with the willingness to continue to provide the money and weapons and political protection to Israel, despite the illegality of these wars, whereas the Democratic majority in the Congress is supporting various ways of trying to undermine that support, but it's not to challenge the Republican-led and Democratic supported by parts of the Democratic Party. It is a bipartisan level of support. So that's where we are. The work that's going on to pressure Congress with these so-called joint resolutions of disapproval. There's another one coming out from Bernie Sanders, I think, at the end of this week or perhaps early next week. The efforts towards getting a War Powers Act resolution signed. These are very important moves within the Congress, not least because they demonstrate to people around the country the degree to which it is possible to challenge this war. There's, I think, a fear among a lot of people that there's just nothing we can do. Congress can move. Congress can reclaim the power that it has given up so profoundly over the last 20 years or more, giving to the executive branch what the Constitution says belongs only to Congress, which is the right to determine whether to go to war. That can be reversed. It hasn't been, and that's going to take a huge fight, but that fight is underway.
And speaking of the fight, where is the fight in terms of, and we're going to let you go after this, I really appreciate the incredibly good information. Where is the fight in the United Nations? You've been engaged at many levels over the years in terms of things happening at the UN. So how do you see that now?
Well, there's good news and bad news. The bad news is that the Security Council remains in the grip of the five permanent members with the veto, and the one country that consistently uses the veto is the United States. And it uses it most of the time these days to protect Israel from being criticized, condemned, or actually held accountable. On the other hand, there's been extraordinarily important developments in both the International Court of Justice, which is the UN arm dealing with international law, and with the General Assembly. So this all started when South Africa brought charges against Israel in the ICJ, a very important move, not least because it was the first effort to actually hold Israel accountable for its war crimes and crimes against humanity, in this case, the question of genocide, but also because it challenged the notion that only the white colonial countries get to use the international court. Having an African country was a real breakthrough there. So we had an initial preliminary judgment from the court. They haven't issued their final result yet. These things move very, very slowly. But their preliminary decision made very clear that the Israeli actions were potentially genocidal. And because of that, they issued a number of requirements of what Israel needed to do. Of course, they had been ignored. But that happened, and then the court also issued, in response to a request from the General Assembly, where there is no veto, an opinion based on the question that was asked, which was, is the Israeli occupation as a whole legal? Because, you know, Dennis, there's all these international laws, the Geneva Conventions, the Hague Conventions, there's a bunch that are basically the laws of war, right, that determine what you can do and not do in the case of war. And one part of it is in the Geneva Conventions is about what happens when territory is occupied during a war. And there's all kinds of protections for civilians. They sometimes get violated, but they're there and they're important about not having collective punishment, not attacking civilian targets, all those things designed to protect civilians. So based on all of that, people thought, well, the court's likely to say something important on this. What they issued was an incredible opinion that said the entire Israeli occupation is illegal, that the entire settlement complex must all be torn down, that or gotten rid of. The settlers must be evacuated. That was the word they used, within 1 year. That year expired this past December. Of course, you saw all those settlers leaving, didn't you, Dennis? Didn't you watch them? You know, of course, all of this has been ignored by Israel. But this is a major change in international law. And as a result of it, the General Assembly issued a resolution, you know, saying we know the court doesn't have an army, have a police force. It doesn't even have a process server, you know, to serve a subpoena on some dictator or some democratically elected person trying to act like a dictator. They passed a resolution with a huge majority. I think it was about 167 to 14 against, if I remember right, which called for a set of sanctions, of an arms embargo, banking sanctions, trade sanctions, sports sanctions, more than the BDS movement probably ever imagined, called for by the United Nations General Assembly. And that resolution was taken under the what's known as the Uniting for Peace precedent at the UN, which a lot of people have been calling on the UN to use. They did use it. They did use that as the basis for this action. But the problem is, even when it's taken under Uniting for Peace, it's not automatically implemented. So what it means is that our movements around the world have to act as the enforcers of international law. We're the only ones that can do it. The UN itself doesn't have the power. Governments will only do it when movements in their countries put the pressure on. It's exactly what happened during the South Africa anti-apartheid movement, when the UN General Assembly passed all these great resolutions but couldn't enforce them till movements started up to pressure those governments to do it. Enough of them did it that the U.S. was under pressure, and that changed everything.
That's a great example, Phyllis. Wow. That's convincing.
It should be the model for us.
Yes.
The model for us, but we have to keep in mind the urgency, because that process around South Africa took about 12 or 15 years. They were not facing genocide in South Africa during those years. There was terrible oppression of the South African population, but it was not genocide. In Gaza, we don't have 12 years, so we have to move fast. That's the challenge.
Wow. All right. Well, Phyllis Bennis, we thank you for giving us so much of your time. Your knowledge and experience over the years has been really instructive and very helpful. Thanks for taking the time for us again. Of course, we have been speaking with Phyllis Bennis, an old friend of Pacifica Radio, and author of, among the other books, Something I Learned a Great Deal from the Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, a Primer.
It's called Understanding Palestine and Israel. Right.
Thanks for the correction, and be safe.
Okay.
And take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Joining us now is a good friend of the show, Richard Silverstein. He blogs at Tikkun Olam, very powerful website. And Richard, welcome back to Flashpoints. A lot going on at a lot of different levels. I wanted to talk to you, first of all, about the sort of what's going on within the progressive or the left of center Jewish community. Are there major, is there major inroads, or are the folks who perhaps weren't willing to open their eyes and see what's going on, are more and more of them taking a little bit of a risk? It's not, I wouldn't call it a siege of support for Palestinian liberation, but do you, you're good at this, do you detect that given the violence and the genocide and the extraordinary treatment of Palestinians, that some people's minds have been changed?
Well, I think so. I want to be guardedly optimistic when I say that, but I wanted to point out to your listeners that the Jewish Federations of North America, which is one of the quintessential Zionist groups of American Canadian Jews, did a poll, and the poll had some findings that I'm sure brought the Federation up short, because it found that among American Jews, only 37% called themselves Zionist. Now, I know there's figures going around the social media based on a Gallup poll that said that 95% of American Jews are Zionist, and that poll was shoddy, and it really asked the question, how do you view Israel favorably, which is not the same as being a Zionist, obviously. And so keep in mind that number, 37%. Say that they're Zionist. This, and for the first time ever, I saw a poll question asking if they were anti-Zionist. 14% said they were anti-Zionist. That may not sound like a large figure to some of your listeners, but that's 1 million American Jews are anti-Zionist. I actually would never have believed, because when I was growing up at the movement decades ago, you know, it felt like we had five Jews in the room that were anti-Zionist. Now it's 1 million Jews. And I have to say, this is sad to say, but as things get worse and worse in the Middle East, as Israel becomes more and more genocidal, there's an equal and opposite reaction among American Jews, especially young American Jews. They're completely disgusted by Israel and by what it's doing. And also, I want to mention that you might think that American Jews, if they were Zionist and if they supported Israel, would be in support of the Iran war, because Israel, of course, is one of the major players. However, American Jews mirror the reaction of Americans at large, and 60 of American Jews are opposed to the war. 66% of Americans in general are opposed to the war. So there's really a quantitative comparability between the us, the American Jews, and the American population at large. So I think that those are promising outcomes, and I think if you also look at American politics and you see the reaction among Democratic candidates in primaries, and quite a few now renouncing support from AIPAC because AIPAC has become toxic. And even candidates who say they will not renounce AIPAC are getting the Kamala Harris treatment. In other words, progressive Democrats are loath to support candidates like Josh Shapiro and others who are avid supporters of AIPAC and taking millions from AIPAC. So all of that, I think, is promising in the long term.
Let me focus you back to Israel now, and it does seem like there have been a few demonstrations that were real, and I guess one way of gauging how real they are is how brutally the Israeli police beat up the protesters. And there's been a couple of pretty high-profile beatings, arrests by Jews who seemed to really be against the genocide and willing to get beaten for it in Israel.
Yeah. So there have been the three major Israeli cities, Haifa, Tel Aviv, and Jerusalem, each one has had demonstrations against the war. And the slogan of the demonstrations is no to war and no to regime change. Now, for Israel, those are not for the United States and our protests here, but in Israel, that is really, those are fighting words because the majority, which are quite right-wing, view this as a treason. Treason against the state of Israel, treason against the war, and all of those things. So, but the fact that there are these protests and that they haven't happened since the beginning of the war, and they didn't really happen in June when Israel attacked Iran, Israel and the U.S. attacked Iran. So this, again, is a positive development. And I just have to add, though, that I'm not a liberal Zionist in that I see this as a sign that Israel and its overall society is becoming more liberal or more social democratic or whatever. It's just in moral terms, I think it's a good thing to see this kind of protest because we need to have some Israelis who are anti-Zionist, who are anti-war, even if we don't believe that they're the majority or that they're going to change Israel in any dramatic fashion. But it's important to have people like that.
Just to stay with you for a few more minutes, you've been involved in a case in Washington State. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. The University of Washington is one of the two major universities in the state, main campus here in Seattle where I am. And the director of the Middle East Center on campus is an Iranian-American professor named Ari Afani. And he had a three-year contract to be the director. And he's under the umbrella of the Jackson School for International Affairs, which is the foreign affairs branch of the university. And so there's a listserv that faculty in Jackson School can use to share information and share their views on various subjects. And so Professor Fani put up two posts on the listserv, and they were harshly critical of Israel for the war. And keep in mind, he's Iranian-American. One of the phrases he used was he called Zionism a cancer. And I think, strong language, obviously, but is it factually true or objectively true or isn't it?
The shoe fits. Right. What size? Yeah.
I think that we both would agree that it is a cancer and, all those, pejorative terms it deserves. However, there's a sort of a MAGA, Jewish MAGA movement here in Seattle, and one of the leaders somehow got the president of the university to join him in a town hall at the MAGA Jewish leaders' synagogue, and during the town hall, this person, the Jewish MAGA guy, he sort of reported. He called for canceling Professor Fani in front of the president of the university. So within a week of that town hall, the director of the Jackson School had fired Professor Fani. So he's no longer the director of the Middle East Center. He has retained his professorship, so he's still, member of the faculty. But it's a major sort of damaging development for his career, and it's extremely damaging for freedom of speech, because what Professor Fani did in those posts on the listserv is protected speech under the First Amendment, and faculty are entitled to First Amendment protection. You and I are entitled to it. It doesn't matter who we are or where we are. We all have that protection. The university, the director of the Jackson School who fired him, violated the First Amendment. I haven't had a chance to speak to the professor about whether he's going to sue the university, but I would think that he would have good grounds to do so, because they took away his job, so there is damages there, and because it's an egregious violation of the First Amendment.
Right, and everybody knows it's he's Iranian, so they had every that from their perspective, they had every reason to fire him without any of this other stuff.
Right,
that's unfortunately the nature of the game. As we live it.
Yeah.
But we do appreciate you for keeping us posted on this. Final word? We got 30 seconds. Speak to the world.
Well, it's
something we should know.
I just want to remind you folks that my blog is Tikkun Olam, and the URL is richardsilverstein.com, and I also publish at The New Arab and Jacobin Magazine. And I just want to thank you for being one of those few media outlets that is presenting my point of view to your audience, and you deserve a lot of respect for it.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Be safe. Let's talk soon.
Thanks, Dennis.
All right. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break. And then Anita Barrows is back. She's been writing a poem, a powerful poem, for every day of this genocide. By the way, that is continuing. The suffering is continuing in the deepest way in Gaza. No matter what happens anywhere else in the world, that suffering, that genocide, was imposed on the people of Gaza, and the suffering continues. We're going to be back and hear about that in the context of poetry. Stay with us. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is Flashpoints, your daily investigative news magazine. We are on the Pacifica Radio Network. That's KPFA in the Bay Area. That's free speech radio, founded in 1949 by folks who understood how important it was to have a free voice. And we continue to exercise that voice with our next guest. And, of course, Anita Barrows joins us. She is a noted translator of the great poet Rilke. She's a fabulous poet in her own right. She's been writing poetry based on the genocide, a poem, a day. And these poems continue. Anita, welcome back to Flashpoints. What number? I'm losing track. I'm not sure. I failed math. I'm not going to be able to count that high.
It is appalling to have to count this high. Today is day 913.
913 yes. Days of a genocide that the whole world continues to watch.
Yes.
Just a bit of a commentary. Exactly. I'm angry today.
Yes, exactly. That the whole world is continuing to watch, and that is being disappeared, certainly from mainstream legacy media. It's as though it's not happening anymore, as though it's over and we've moved on to other things.
Speak to us. Tell us some poems. Tell us what's going on. And yes, tell us also, take a little time to tell us about your students. I always want to tell people that you have students in Gaza studying poetry with you, and that's a part of this contribution that you're making to the world.
I do. I have poetry. These amazing young people. One of them today sent me four pictures wearing a cap and gown and holding balloons. She has graduated from the Islamic University of Gaza. She's studied English and translation. She's extraordinary. She lives in a tent in Khan Yunis. She's there with her father, who has epilepsy, who cannot get his anti-seizure medications, and so he has been having seizures, and she's been helping him through them. And with it all, she has graduated online. There are no university buildings left, but the professors are teaching from their tents online. So Shams Mazen Rajab is her name, and I think we can all congratulate her on what is an extraordinary achievement.
Nice. Read to us. Read for us, please.
Great. So day 913. This was from a photograph I saw.
What's happening? Dude, we just lost... okay, are we live on the air now? Okay, so we lost Anita. Let's see if we can get her back. I'm not sure what's happening in the connection, but let's see if we can put on some music and call her back. Okay? Anita, we lost you there. I'm not sure what happened, but why don't you pick it up from the beginning and tell us about, and read a couple of poems for us, okay?
Sure, thank you. Day 913, Saturday morning. Four friends gather in the square near where they live. Incredibly, the square is still there, their buildings there, Gaza City. They meet, exchange news from their week. A cousin who died of something that could have been cured, a nephew martyred, an old teacher whose leg had to be amputated. Four friends, friends since childhood, friends who met at that square every week, sometimes bringing their very young children, sometimes bringing a ball they could kick the way they used to before the genocide. Then the airstrike. They hear planes approaching. They run. Too late. The photograph shows one of them being carried into an ambulance on a stretcher. They'll pronounce him dead at the hospital. His friends will follow. Four gone. A sunny morning. A morning that began like any other. This is yesterday, day 912. Warships hover in the sea where no fishers can fish, where children who used to leap over waves can only stand on the beach, stare at the horizon, the other side of which is free. They talk to each other. The sound of the waves accompanies their words, their eyes, their voices can leap. There, beyond where the sea meets the sky, no one is starving. No one has lost their mother and father. Everyone goes to school. All the children have arms and legs. There are no warships that fire tents whose flimsy panels sway, collapse. There are no deaths from gunfire, explosions, where wind carries only the smell of salt and jasmine, opening roses. You just imagine, as children do, a life beyond the life that they're having to live, the life that's imposed on them. This is 2 days ago, day 9/11. Her infant, a living corpse, heart beating, still inhaling, exhaling, but being consumed. The mother had, moments earlier, fallen asleep when she woke to screams, a large rat gnawing her infant's face, teeth marks sunken into his cheek, blood pooling everywhere in the tent, fresh meat for rodents to feed on, not even waiting for death to wage the initial slaughter. Now the mother is thinking, it's not just what falls from the sky that we have to fear, but rodents digging from under wet ground, ground saturated with sewage, rot, a new enemy named. This is happening now in the tent camps, a huge station of rodents. This is day 9/10. If anybody heard Nora's report, a group of infants who had been taken from the neonatal intensive care unit at, I believe it was Al-Shifa Hospital, because Israel had cut electricity and the incubators weren't functioning and the infants all were going to die. So the infants were evacuated a couple of years ago, right after the beginning of the genocide, and the ones who were alive were just returned. Day 910. The look on this small child's face says everything. Her mother, grandmother, grandfather are waiting for her when the bus arrives, carrying the children still alive who were taken from the NICU when the hospital shut down, when power was cut by the enemy, disabling the incubators they needed to survive. Evacuated to Egypt, mothers not allowed to accompany them, families anguished, bereft at home, not knowing if they would live, not knowing if they'd seen their babies for the final time. This little girl with brown curly hair and glasses is handed to her mother. Her mother takes her in her arms, flanked by her parents. The grandfather behind the child being held adjusts her little glasses, which have slipped down her nose, a gesture of tenderness, of care, of everything he has missed. The adults are smiling with joy. The child, who has never seen her mother since the earliest days of her life, stares out at the crowd of people. All she has been through, hunger, fear, loss, confusion, now more confusion, is written there in her expression. Where am I? Who are these people? Her tiny hands hold the tension. She cannot speak.
That's the voice of Anita Barros. Anita has been writing a poem for every day of the continuing genocide. I think that's part of the surface of the service that you are doing in presenting these poems. You're reminding us that this genocide continues, and it continues on a daily basis. Sometimes the bombings are heavier than other times, but everybody knows not only what the Israelis have in store for the Palestinians if they're given free rein. But we can see that they want to do a similar favor for the Lebanese people. And so we see that extraordinary bombing of Palestinians, that resistance going on. So we are grateful to you, Anita, and to the work that your daughter does, Nora Barros Friedman, at the Electronic Intifada. It's become a family affair, and we depend on both of you. We play the newscast. I should tell people who appreciate this programming and knowing the truth about this genocide, we play the newscast of the Electronic Intifada with Nora Barros Friedman on Thursdays. Usually at 5 o'clock, we will be playing it. If it's on, we will be playing it. Because the news, the real news and the continuing news and the suffering, we really stop anybody on the street, and 99 out of 100 don't have a real clue about the nature of suffering and what we are paying for with U.S. tax dollars. We do have a poem or two more, time for a poem or two more, Anita, if you'd like.
Wonderful. I'd love that. Day 909. She 909. Had a new dress. She, 909. Just 4 days ago. She had a new dress she was going to wear when school began. It was just school in a tent, school with whatever children happened to be around, school taught by someone's mother, someone's older sister. Not real school, her brother taunted her, but she'd learn to read. She'd learn about other places, about creatures who live in the sea and creatures who live in the jungle. She wore the dress the whole day she got it, handed down from a girl in another tent. She showed her cousins how it looked, showed her brother, her uncle. She wore it under the thin blanket that covered her in the tent. Wore it though she knew it would be wrinkled. She did not know it would be soaked in blood, unrecognizable, had no way of knowing after the airstrike that no one at school would ever see it. And this is day 908. From deep under the earth, a mother is calling to her children. Don't come to me, she is crying, her voice muffled by layers of dead above her, beneath her, muffled by ravaged soil, by the roots of everything trying to grow. Are you warm enough? Are you eating enough? She's calling. Are you taking care of your brothers, your grandfather? She asks the older ones. Stay where you are, or leave if you need to leave. Remember to look vigilantly around you, to watch for snipers, to watch the sky, to watch for rips in the tent, for insects in the food, for rashes, swellings, fevers. Remember, I'm with you, even when I'm not.
We're out of time. Was the line, the mom says, don't come here, please?
Yes, don't come. Don't come to me. Don't come to me. Don't let yourself be killed like I was.
Powerful. Thank you. Thank you, Anita Barros, for doing this. And we will keep sharing this time with you until this genocide hopefully will be over, and then we will make sure that people have this book, this big book that could hold back a big door. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you,
Anita. Be safe.
Thank you.
And that does it for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. Our theme music is...
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial.
Is autism an epidemic? Or is it a superpower? Are you a little bit on the spectrum? Or are you hashtag